It all happened when Moses was gone. Moses, who had told them what the Lord had said. The Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have given heed to you and to what has been done to you in Egypt. I declare that I will bring you up out of the misery of Egypt to a land flowing with milk and honey. It all happened when Moses was gone. Moses, who had been with them all this time through sea and wilderness all the way to this mountain. And here at this mountain, Moses had told him all the words of the Lord, beginning with the first. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Here at this mountain, the Lord had made a covenant with them, and when Moses had finished reading the book of the covenant in their hearing, they said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will obey. And who can doubt that they meant it? Then Moses went back up on the mountain, and he was gone for a long, long time. Perhaps you wonder what the people said or did next, but you'll have to wait too. Because it's page after page of the Lord giving instructions to the worship committee, detailed instructions about the tabernacle and the ark and the lampstand and the curtain and the vestments and the altar and how to properly ordain the priests and the Sabbath. The last we heard the people say was a firm commitment to being the Lord's covenant partner. We will do and we will obey. And the next time we hear them speak, we see them right here, gathered around Aaron, saying, come make a God for us, who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. And Aaron, without a moment's hesitation, obliged them. Perhaps he was glad to be able to do something, anything, to satisfy the people's religious needs. It all happened when Moses was gone. And that absence, in a way, was like a dress rehearsal for what was to come. They would have to learn to live as God's people without Moses, but with the commandments, with the liturgy, and with the priests. Needless to say, they failed, and they did so spectacularly. The very first thing they did after giving their full-throated commitment to the covenant and the commandments of God was a crude and frontal assault on the first one of those commandments that is at the heart of all of them. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Moses up on the mountain had no idea what was going on, but God told him, go down at once. Your people, whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt, have acted perversely. They have been quick to turn aside from the way that I commanded for them. Did you notice how frequently this line pops up in the story and how confused things are about who exactly it is who brought out Israel from Egypt? The people point to Moses, the man who brought us up. Aaron points to the calf. These are your gods that brought you up. God at first said, I brought you out, but now points to Moses, telling him that his people are saying it was that shiny thing that Aaron had made that had brought them out. And then in a moment, not unlike the one when the Lord told Noah to build an ark because he alone was righteous and the world was corrupt, the Lord offers to scrap Israel and start over with Moses. I have seen this people, how stiff-necked they are. Now let me alone, so that my wrath may burn hot against them and I may consume them, and of you I will make a great nation. This clearly isn't working. Let's start over, you and I together. What a tempting offer for some. But Moses didn't step out of the way and into the possibilities of being the new Abraham or the new Israel. No, he throws himself against the wrath of God and talks back. Why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt with great power? It wasn't my mighty hand that led them out, nor Aaron's, nor Miriam's. This is your people. This is your doing. This is your promise. Remember, turn, change your mind. I don't think Moses sounded nearly as kind as Sarah just did. Terence Fretheim says that in this story we learn that God is not the only one who has something important to say. This covenant isn't solely defined by divine declaration and human obedience, but by a relationship that invites human understanding, human speech. It is Moses' prayer, Moses' voice in the midst of God's fury that moves this moment from mere repetition of the past to new possibilities of fulfillment. What a remarkable line. And the Lord changed his mind about the disaster that he planned to bring on his people. Human prayer, says Fretheim, is honored by God as a contribution to a conversation that has the capacity to change the future directions for God, people, and world. God may well adjust modes and directions, though not ultimate goals, in view of such human responsiveness. This means that there is genuine openness to the future on God's part, fundamentally in order that God's salvific will for all might be realized as fully as possible. The Lord changed his mind about the disaster that he planned to bring on his people. In this openness to change is revealed what is unchangeable about God. God's steadfastness has to do with God's love. God's faithfulness has to do with God's promises. God's will is for the salvation of all. God will always act, even make changes, in order to be true to these unchangeable ways and to accomplish these unchangeable goals. Making the calf was an act of idolatry, despite Aaron's declaration that there would be a festival of the Lord. It was idolatry because the God who brought Israel out of Egypt, the God who is faithful to God's promises, cannot be produced by the whim of the people who get anxious in the absence of the prophet. The God of the Exodus is free and sovereign and never an object of our artful manipulation, no matter if the object is carved in stone, cast in gold, or put into words. This story opens our eyes to the great sin of substituting an available God, a convenient God, a manufactured God, for the free and sovereign one who is not immediately available. Moses' absence points to the risk of faith we think we can avoid by domesticating God to manageable proportion. So calf making is more than just an episode in Israel's history. It is the perennial temptation for a people drawn into covenant with this God. The people who ask Aaron to do something, to make something for them, are intensely religious, hungry for God's presence. But rather than deal with God on God's terms, they ask the priest to give them something they can see, they can touch, they can feel. Moses' prayer, on the other hand, reveals the terms of this God, terms that go beyond obedience and worship. This God responds to deep human involvement in wrestling with a tension between divine will and human reality, between mercy that forgives and sovereignty that will not be mocked. Yes, there is joy in heaven over every human being, man, woman, or child, who clings to the promises of God and insists that God be faithful, especially when we are not. Sin has terrible consequences. But what we hear in this word, and in every gospel word, is that they will not include the final rupture of the relationship between God and God's people. Because God is faithful to the point of bearing human sin with all its consequences. After coming down the mountain, and after frightening displays of wrath and violence, Moses prayed again. Although this is a stiff-necked people, pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us for your inheritance. And as in the darkness of Good Friday, God refused to give up on us, this stiff-necked people. Thanks be to God.